Hello, Ramnath. Welcome to KABU here in Portland, Oregon.
Thank you, Bill.
Ramnath is an expert among experts on the nuclear industries, both weaponry and electricity generation. He's written many, many articles and testified around the world, written several books. We will discuss how nuclear power is again rising from the dead, seeking to become the primary replacement for fossil fuels, the great international effort to contain climate change and avoid planetary and human catastrophe. And nuclear plants have gained many rich and influential supporters, including Bill Gates. Indeed, also most corporate elites are now coming to support the technological miracle, technological innovation, as the way to deal with climate change that leaves them still in control of society and running their industries and maintaining the capitalist system. So, Ramnath, tell us about the perils of nuclear power and the latest very serious pitch by Bill Gates and the nuclear industry, in fact, much of the corporate elite, pitching for huge federal subsidies, huge as
an understatement, yes. That's a great question to start with. And I will begin by noting the oddity of people even thinking about nuclear energy as an environmentally friendly source of power. For anybody who has seen what has happened in so many parts of the world, like Chernobyl and Three Mile Island, and from all the big anti-nuclear movements galvanizing against nuclear waste disposal and so on, starting from the 1970s, it should be a big surprise. You know, the problems with nuclear power are quite well known. There's the problem of accidents. We are speaking on the eve of the 10th anniversary of the accidents at Fukushima Daiichi in Japan, which started on 11th March of 2011. Most people around the world would have seen those nuclear power plants exploding on their TV screens. And for people who are older, they may also remember what happened in Chernobyl. So the risk of catastrophic accidents is something that is inherent to nuclear power and occurs because you are dealing with a very complex technological system that is filled with hazardous materials like radioactive fission products and so on, which are interacting with each other and operating at high temperatures and pressures, all of which make for the possibility of accidents. The second problem with nuclear power that is should be well known is the fact that as a byproduct of the fission reactions that produce the energy in a nuclear power plant, these reactions also produce what are called fission products, which are radioactive materials, which have extremely long half-lives. In other words, they are hazardous to human beings till they decay into something stable, and that can take of the order of tens of thousands of years to hundreds of thousands of years. So for this unprecedented long period of time, we have to try to steward this and make sure that people are not going to come into contact with it. And there's almost no way we can confidently be assured that these can be kept away from human beings. And this has been a second problem. The last problem with nuclear power is the other thing you alluded to, which is the linkage between the ability to generate nuclear energy and the production of materials like plutonium and highly enriched uranium that can be used to make nuclear weapons. And that connection is something that goes back all the way to the bombs that were dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The technologies that were developed, the materials for those bombs, are exactly the technologies that have been modified to also generate nuclear energy. So these three problems are, I think, inherent to nuclear power, and there is nothing you can do to rid them of those connections.
Yeah, and you will point out in some of your articles, it's also vastly expensive. They're always underestimating the cost and the time it takes. The climate of the world might be 150-degree average before they finish their first plant, especially with their new designs that are even more dangerous than the old designs. They claim, of course, they're safer.
I would just want to say one thing. These problems with nuclear energy are well known, and the fact that nuclear energy is being reconsidered today has to do with the problem that you mentioned, which is the current ruling class's inability to deal with the climate crisis. And the reason they find it impossible to deal with it is because they don't want to let go of the current social, economic, and political means that have allowed them to profit and become the richer class here and being able to dominate over so many other people. And as long as they are not willing to forego the sort of underlying capitalist desire for continued economic growth and profits, they will always be looking for some kind of a technological fix. And nuclear energy fits into that very well because it uses very similar sort of systems as the fossil fuel plants that currently generate the bulk of the electricity around the world. And so in that sense, some of the elites see this as a way to continue with life as usual, but just replace coal plants with nuclear plants or gas plants with nuclear plants.
This is Bill Resnick talking to Amino. We've been discussing the perils of nuclear energy. There's a big push on now. It's sort of not noticed, passing references to it in the major newspapers and even the left papers. The nuclear power industry has a lot of allies, as Ramana just discussed. Most of the capitalist class is supporting a technical fix to climate change, that is a technical innovation. And
yeah.
Furthermore, there's the Boy Billionaires Club, as they were referred to, Bill Gates and others, who spent a huge amount of money screwing up U.S. public education by supporting charter school development. In fact, now these smartest boys in the world, who actually know very, very little except how to organize technology to make vast amounts of money. They're really good at that. But they're now pushing nuclear energy, and my sense is also the investor-owned utilities are pushing not so much for nuclear energy, but for the big grid, the continent-spanning huge grid that the investor-owned utilities need. Ramana, tell us about that push now in the Biden administration. They're influencing the Biden administration, in fact, taking posts in it.
Yeah, let's talk about Gates, because I think he is actually quite emblematic of so many things that are happening. So Bill Gates, as you know, has sort of been on the talk radio, talk TV circuit, pushing his new book, where he argues essentially that what we need to do to deal with climate change is innovate. Right? You know, one should mention this surprising fact that people like Bill Gates, the loudest voices for promoting this innovation idea, are the ones that have made the most money doing this innovation thing in the past, right? And so it's no surprise that they should be promoting, quote-unquote, innovation, technological innovation. But I think what is more interesting about Bill Gates' approach is that he has been investing in a company called TerraPower that is trying to develop some nuclear power plants. We don't know exactly how much he's invested, but I would guess that he's probably invested a few million dollars, maybe $20 million, I don't know exactly, but something of that order of magnitude, right? And then what he does is go down to Washington, D.C. or to Beijing or something and say, you governments, you ought to be investing in this. And the reason he has to do that is because it costs roughly of the order of $1 to $2 billion to move one of these paper designs like what they have come up with at TerraPower into something that can actually be constructed, right? It requires a lot of engineering work, a lot of testing before you can go ahead and confidently build one of these. And these companies are not willing to invest that kind of money. What they are willing to do, this investors, is basically give a small amount of pocket change so that you can hire a bunch of scientists and engineers and some PR people and some marketing people and then produce a bunch of nice-looking PowerPoint slides that can be flashed around the world, right? They ultimately want the public to be investing in it, right? So the idea is sort of very similar to how a lot of so-called innovation happens in today's neoliberal capitalist economy, which is that you try to privatize any profit that you get, but you socialize all the costs and the risks. And that's the general philosophy under which this is happening. And now you ask me about how utilities are considering building nuclear power plants, and you can look at where nuclear power plants are being built and where they're not being built. So in the United States, for the bulk of the country, the electricity market is liberalized, which means that basically electricity is bought and sold like any other commodity on a market. And this happened in the 1990s. Prior to that, the way it was done was that there would be some kind of a state body, a public utilities commission or something, that would determine that this particular region required a new plant. It could be a big hydroelectric dam, it could be a windmill, whatever it is. And then they would say, this is something which we are going to be requiring in a few years, therefore we are going to authorize construction of this. And the customer base of that particular electric utility will be paying for the costs eventually. That's a practice that is still followed in some states in the U.S., for example, in the states of Georgia and South Carolina, which were the only two states to have tried to build nuclear plants in this century. Right? And in those states, essentially, the construction was propelled by the state legislatures allowing these utilities to charge customers even before they actually built the plant and started generating electricity. As a result, people in South Carolina are paying billions of dollars towards a plant that was actually ultimately canceled. So, in effect, the utility spent about $9 billion to dig a deep hole, essentially. So, and the only reason they're able to do these kinds of things is because ultimately it's the taxpayer and the ratepayers who are going to pay for all of this. So the talk about all this innovation and, you know, the free market and so on and so forth, it's really not free. It's actually common people who are paying these costs and bearing the risks.
This is Bill Resnick for the OMO interviewing Ramana. We just discussed the nuclear power industry's very serious and hopefully last gasp efforts to become the primary provider of electric power in this country, indeed around the world. We discussed the great perils of nuclear energy, as well as the preference, the very strong preference of the capitalist elite to fund nuclear energy as a way of dealing with climate change. What the nuclear energy people promise, a completely false promise, but rich and powerful in the United States really want to believe it. When you want to believe a false promise, or as we've learned recently, it's very easy. They want to maintain their system and nuclear power. Nuclear power advocates claim that they, in fact, will produce enough energy quickly and inexpensively with our new designs to make sure that really the United States does not have to change its production system or build a culture of energy conservation and use reduction. Ramana, one of the reasons that nuclear energy has been defeated in the past is that there is a great popular opposition backed up by analyses of nuclear power such as yours, and of course knowledge, as you pointed out, of the great nuclear plant disasters, Chernobyl and Fukushima and Three Mile Island, right here made in the USA. I think it's a certainty is that the strong public opposition will also be necessary this time around. It has to intensify and take powerful political position right now because the Biden administration will certainly continue its subsidy to the nuclear industry through the Department of Energy. It's sort of well known in professional circles, but not by the public. We've been giving several billion dollars a year to the nuclear power industry just to keep them alive. And, of course, the military wants that also because, as you pointed out, it's linked to the nuclear weapons development system and gives them a lot of research support. Ramana, tell us about the Biden administration and the Biden energy plans and the possibilities of, in fact, resisting the very strong and powerful demands by the industry to subsidize them and give them near unlimited access to the federal treasury.
Yeah. So there's good news and bad news there. The good news is that I think everybody realizes that nuclear power plants are very expensive to construct. So the actual sets of plans to construct them one can count on the fingers of one hand in the United States. And I don't think that is likely to change before the Biden administration's term is up. We are not going to see a dramatic increase in plans to construct anytime in the next 4 years or 8 years for that matter. What I think is the bad news is that the Biden administration has taken essentially all of the above, you know, we're not going to rule out anything, we want to make friends with everybody kind of approach. There's a little bit of money there for electric vehicles, there is money for nuclear power, there is money for renewables, there's money for batteries, there's money for hydrogen, you know, you name it, they sort of want to do it. And it goes back to the larger question that we were talking about, which is the fact that they would like to see this problem be solved by some kind of a technological miracle. Because they don't want to make any strong sort of political or social changes, their only way of trying to deal with this is to go into all possible technologies and try to win over different sections of the elite for their project. I think that's the way to sort of think about what the Biden administration is doing.
Sanders, Ocasio, Green New Deal forces, proposals and their public acceptance by a good deal of the population found it attractive. Biden, in running for president, set up groups to advise to develop a climate action plan. And they have to include, therefore, the Sanders, Ocasio, some radical people. And I think that led to his infrastructure plan. But those are all sort of awaiting future action, and it would be future action by the Congress, who is quite conservative and generally dances to the tune of the various big corporate employers in their state and money providers. It seems to me that it's the appropriation process. It's going to be the writing of those infrastructure plans, which will very likely not get through, regardless of what Biden thinks or even some of his advisors, unless they satisfy these various interests in Congress, like Joe Manchin, who's going to be pushing for carbon sequestration. That's another one of their great technologies. You just take the carbon out of the air and put it somewhere. All sorts of interests are there. My sense is that unless the American people really rise up in opposition, the final plan on appropriations is going to be heavily weighted towards this innovation stuff. What's your sense of that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, innovation by itself is not a good thing or a bad thing. It really depends on what you're innovating and why you're innovating and what the aim of that innovation is, right? And I think the biggest challenge we should be thinking about is that as a country, as a civilization, we are well beyond the ecological limits that our planet can bear with. And despite what people like Elon Musk say, unfortunately, this is the only planet we have, right? And so if you're trying to, quote-unquote, innovate to figure out how we're going to live more simply with using less resources, you know, the idea that you can innovate in a way as to maintain the current economic model of continued growth is not going to work. That's point one. Point two, you're absolutely right about talking about the importance of social and political movements on the ground to be able to challenge these things. And I think the Green New Deal, in a way, is a very interesting idea, an innovative idea, to use the same term, by which you're trying to solve multiple problems, or at least address multiple problems. Climate change is not seen as completely divorced from all of the social and political hierarchies that people are dealing with. The fact that, you know, people of color, women, and all kinds of disadvantaged groups are not having a great time in this current world is something that the Green New Deal seeks to address. You cannot expect to have support for a transition away from fossil fuels until you deal with the problems of the unemployment that is going to result from laying off miners and coal plant workers and so on. All those different issues have to be addressed if you are going to have any kind of popular support, right? So just trying to have a social movement purely focused on either stopping nuclear power plants or dealing with climate change is going to be inadequate. Ironically, in a way, the bigger the problem is, perhaps the greater the interest is going to be in terms of a social movement.
We're going to have to end, Ramana. So very soon, we'll have to discuss the alternative to nuclear power. That is a system that actually has a chance to contain climate change and save the planet. That system is locally produced sun and wind energy that can be democratically run, and I mean authentic participatory democracy. It could create also a culture of energy conservation and use reduction. These local systems that are confederated for reliability and that are easy to repair, that are very cheap and off-the-shelf materials, doesn't need a vast grid and the trillions of dollars that would have to be spent. And we only have maybe 10 years to do it. To the climate scientists, that's necessary actually to contain climate change to manageable levels. And if not, most of us humans are in trouble, and perhaps the whole species. Again, we'll be discussing this very soon.
I will say, when people try to argue against sources of power like nuclear energy, they are usually told that we cannot meet people's electricity needs with renewable sources, and the standard phrase for that is the sun doesn't shine all the time, the wind doesn't blow all the time. Now, that is, of course, true. But that is a gross simplification of what we have. There are many ways of trying to generate electricity, and just, you know, solar panels and wind turbines are not the only thing. There are other renewable sources, including geothermal energy, energy from tide, hydropower, small hydropower, different kinds of solar technologies, and so on. And there's also the possibility of geographical diversity. So the fact that there's no wind blowing in Oregon does not mean that there's going to be no wind blowing in Iowa at the same time. And there are ways by which you can try to connect those things and make a more reliable grid.
Ramana, thanks so much for talking to us, and we'll do it again.
Thank you so much, Bill. It was a pleasure talking to you, and I look forward to talking again.
So long.
Bye-bye.